Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Label Sessions podcast, Greg. We know you as an expert in IT security, but somebody with a focus on, I guess, reframing how security happens today. So the big organizations taking a strategic view rather than getting pulled into kind of constant firefighting that is maybe typical of the role, or at least, I guess, what I see in the world. So I think in essence, we kind of know you as someone who helps make organizations be less vulnerable rather than managing the risk of ever-growing vulnerabilities. So maybe to kick things off for us, could you give a sense of your career journey so far and how you got into IT security?
Sure, yeah. I think that's not a bad description. So I started out basically as it's a really convoluted story, but teenage hacker. My sister brought home a VHS copy of the film Hackers, which taught me that if I break into computers, I get to be with Angelina Jolie. That led me to learn a lot about computers and eventually break into a nuclear weapons facility. That led to me spending a few years working undercover with the U.S. federal government, a job offer I couldn't refuse. They're quite adamant about the last bit.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then kind of, you know, went on to being, you know, the kind of like rock star syndrome, very technical, all the latest, greatest security technologies. And, you know, that started 25, 26 years ago. And probably 10 years in, I started realizing that I'm more of a problem solver than an IT person. And looking at the big picture and how pieces fit together, and we're just doing a bunch of stuff with technology, but we don't actually understand what for. Like, are we actually helping the business? Are we really stopping breaches? Are we just, you know, focalizing on one area because we like to play with tech and ignoring another 500 that can easily bypass what we're doing? And you start looking at the macro trends of the industry of, you know, every year we spend more money on cybersecurity, and the result is that every year things get worse, and no industry with a mature approach has a trend like that. And then I think, you know, back to what you said in the beginning, I started out, I basically became responsible, or I felt responsible for the security of the organization. And I started realizing, well, there's not a lot of visibility. There's not a lot of accountability to what we do in security, because no one really knows what you're supposed to be doing, let alone whether you're actually doing it. And if you screw up, you get your budget doubled. So there's not a lot of incentive to do a really good job. So I started first, well, okay, all these technical tools, are we even leveraging them properly? Are we, you know, are we thinking about the process? Are they well documented? And even when that was the case, then I started realizing, well, there's a lot of other things going on outside of IT that we don't even know about. So how can we possibly manage those risks if we're not more engaged with the rest of the business? And then I started realizing everything we do is reactive. It's firefighting. We are constantly escalating or increasing our risk management capacity, which sounds like a good thing until you realize that, well, if we did quality management instead of risk management, we wouldn't have nearly as much risk to manage. And it's a cumulative, sustainable decrease, which is the defect or incident trends you see in every other industry, where you just kind of, it's downward trend where you keep a little bit of residual, and that's where the risk management should start and stay. We don't do that. We just go on and on and on, and you're spending more and more of your company's money, but you're not actually ever removing the causes of the vulnerabilities, and you're not stopping the organization or even making them aware enough to stop creating new sources of vulnerabilities. So you're scaling the reasons you have vulnerabilities now while allowing the business to introduce more reasons to have more vulnerabilities in the future, instead of quality managing, you know, the business process and the IT process that's causing you to have all these issues that constantly need firefighting in the first place.
I guess a huge snowball effect. And just hearing you, it was fascinating to kind of hear your journey into, I guess, where you're where you are today. And I guess hearing it, it sounds like you started in your kind of a, sounds like quite interesting. I'm sure we'll have a podcast maybe all about your time working in the Department of Defense, not by choice. maybe we can't talk about that at all. But that feels like that's very much the worm's eye view. So you had an area of expertise, accidentally or whatever, hacking into systems that you they didn't want you to be there. So that's very much, I guess, that worm's eye view, being kind of a very kind of a deep into a particular facet of a thing, of a system or whatever. And it feels like you've kind of navigated to a bit of a bird's eye view now, thinking about not just the vertical of IT and then the kind of subset of security in an organization, but how do you take this bird's eye view across all the verticals in a business to do things differently? So don't make more. The more you, I got a sense of the snowball effect that you were talking about around there are increasing vulnerabilities. And if you don't tackle quality assurance, they just get worse. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Let me ask you, you talked about believing companies should be kind of a focusing more on making themselves less vulnerable than managing risk. Thinking about, and you explained like really well kind of why that is, but what about the kind of a fintech community, especially in the UK where I'm talking to you from? Do you see fintechs or startups even demonstrating greater security awareness than big companies? I'm just curious if you have a perspective on kind of a, I guess, born in digital companies versus huge big enterprises that have been here for a while.
At the macro big level, I don't actually see a fundamental difference between all these things. I want to clarify something. When you say like, organizations should be less vulnerable, a lot of people in security will agree with that. It's like, yeah, that's what we're doing. But what they're doing is they're taking the fact that all these threats are out there for granted. They're taking the facts that they have all these vulnerabilities inside for granted. And their idea of being less vulnerable is to erect all these defenses and detection and response and other stuff, not to actually be less vulnerable. Not to have something. It's like my house is made of rice paper, but I've put all these guards and security systems in front. That's what makes you, build the house out of bricks, and then you don't need all these extra things. So already just in the verbiage, it's very tricky. And we have this fundamental problem in security where we think doing more of that means more security. That's the definition of what security has become, and it's incredibly difficult to overcome that perception and even how words have been used. I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, but it's an important point. And I thought of this analogy like the other day, like two neighbors have the same car. And what protects the engine of the car? It's the oil. And one neighbor just drives his car, 10,000 miles a year and gets it serviced once a year. And the other neighbor puts a gallon of oil in it every single morning because it's low every single morning. And one neighbor says, well, that doesn't quite seem right. Whereas the neighbor who's spending 100 quid a day on oil says, no, oil is what protects my engine. I'm using a lot more of it than you are. So clearly I'm protecting my engine better than you are, which is absurd. But it's how we're doing it in security. Instead of fixing the gasket, we are adding more and more and more of these things, which are quite often like, I see organizations are like, oh, we have so many security controls. I'm like, that's actually a bad sign. That's actually a sign that you have a huge number of underlying issues that require all this mitigation. And that's something that's very difficult to get people to understand, especially in security, because they're so kind of myopic on this tech focus and that this is what security should represent. But once you flip it to, security should be a quality function. And if you have high quality business processes and high quality IT processes that don't breed issues, misconfigurations, bad build, poor architecture, all these things, then you don't end up having all these issues to remediate in the first place. And that's the general, the gist of it. What needs to happen for that is A, you need to make your senior management aware. B, you need to have structure, because even the technical people who understand these things, they'll agree with you. They say, yeah, but I don't own where the problems come from, so I can't do anything about it. That's a sign of a very immature industry, because if you look at aviation, and I used to use an analogy that was very, very similar to what just happened to Boeing, except with me, in my analogy, it was the bolts holding the wings with slacken during flight. So you've manufactured this new aircraft, you sell a few hundred, airlines start using it, and then some technician somewhere at Alaska Airlines notices that the bolts holding the wings on slacken. That's going to cause a disaster at some point. It's very dangerous. So what's the solution? Well, you build a workshop in every single airport in the world where these planes fly to, and you take them off the tarmac at the end of every flight, and you inspect and retorque the bolts to minimize the odds of the wings falling off on the next flight. That's ridiculous. The reaction I got when I first told it to someone who wasn't a security person said, no, you wouldn't, that's stupid. But it's how we operate in security. Now, what would actually happen is that, oh, this isn't right. Let's inspect what's going on, figure it out, change the design of the fastener, incorporate that design into the overall design for, you know, the fastener and how that's going to fix the wing, change the manufacturing process to incorporate that. Everything's fine. We retrofit what's left in the field, and that problem is gone. That problem is gone. You never have to deal with it again. And you have the bonus that you learn something, so your future fasteners will incorporate what you've learned, and you won't have a repeat of this incident in other types of fasteners. The Alaska airline technician does not work for Boeing. Doesn't even work for the same company, but there is a structure in place. All these things kicked up and were made possible because we realized this is the best way of doing it. We don't have that in most companies when it comes to security. That's within the same company. So these are things like, if you're a CISO, this is one of the very first things you need to establish. You know, you need to establish the possibility of fixing problems at source. You need to explain the cost benefits of doing that. And you have to be willing to, I'm going to help the business be very efficient in its quality and security, and I'm not going to get a £50 million a year budget with 25 heads because I won't need them. Like, you have to be altruistic to the organization. I think most executives are paid for in equity based on performance and savings, whereas most security leaders measure themselves in how much headcount and budget they have. That's not a good incentive if you want people to start addressing things at source. So I try to help people. I think the other thing is strategy. And I often give the example of, if you're a CEO walking into a belittled or a troubled company, and you ask, you're trying to figure out what's going on, who's good, who's not, what are we doing right, what are we doing wrong, and you go talk to your chief marketing officer, what is our marketing strategy, and they just tell you, oh, we're going to buy all these tools, but they have no awareness of the organization, the customer, the product, well, they're fired. That's not a strategy. But yeah, I work in organizations where customers send us their strategies and could you fulfill this? It's like, this is literally just a shopping list that you got off Gartner. It doesn't even mention what kind of business you do, your business processes, what data, where, who uses it, what they need it for. They have no awareness. So you have no strategy. Usually there's no program documenting how things should work, either within the security function or in other parts of the business, so they don't incur security issues. And that is something you have to define, and that's something that should also be delivering your strategy. You don't have the structure to be able to address things at cause, and there's no focus on addressing things at cause. And that's the kind of stuff that I try to help organizations with. And fact is, most security people probably don't like me for it. I get far more traction with executives than I do with most security people, because this makes sense to them. Quality management makes sense to them. Cost efficiencies make sense to them. Calculating the actual, I think in security, we're very obsessed with risk management and, you know, trying to qualify risk, but it's a completely arbitrary thing. You see all these calculations, but there's so many other dependencies. And I've audited a lot, and what gets companies breached is rarely, if ever, on their risk register, fundamentally. So trying to calculate all these things is pointless. But if instead you can say, well, it's going to cost X to mitigate, or by fixing, you know, the source of these vulnerabilities, especially if you look at it as a quality function, like, okay, our engineering function is causing loads of vulnerabilities. We need to change the leadership, skill them up, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't just give me a huge reduction in vulnerabilities, which decreases risk. It also decreases my costs because I've got less risk to manage. But chances are it'll make them more efficient as well, because if they start creating better code, better architected code, simpler code, well, now you have a faster product. You have a a more stable product. You're using less cloud resource. We've got one instance where like the cloud savings paid for the security function twice over, just from this kind of scenario. So you can calculate those cost savings from a quality enhancement standpoint, and that's something you can take to your CFO. You go from security functions constantly being under pressure by the CFO to, look, engineering saving $300K a year cutting this corner, but it's costing us $500,000 to mitigate. So this is costing us an extra $200K a year. And at the end of the year, you realize, you know, the CFO is your best friend because you're finding all these cost savings, kind of helping organizations achieve that. I'll let you ask questions now. Sorry.
You said a bunch of things there, Greg, that were really, really interesting. But I want to pick up on maybe a couple of things. So this is the problem. Security is the thing that people feel like they don't, because they don't know a lot of information about it or actually the mechanics behind it, it feels like there's some kind of a layer of confusion from people in the business to people in security. So what I'm actually trying to do is really understand what you're saying. And there were a few things within that was really interesting for me. I think there's parallels with innovation, because innovation or customer experience, really, to do it well, you've got to cross all the verticals in a business, because it's not just about how you talk to a customer, but it's all the operations that enable people within the business to serve the customer. And I guess that's my world. So that's the parallels I see, is really kind of cutting through all the verticals. You mentioned Boeing and planes, which I love because I'm a bit of a airline geek for my sins. And I think, so I want to talk to you about the risk register stuff and why security is so different from other industries, because the way you articulate it, Greg, makes it sound so obvious. And so it makes me think, why are you different from a lot of your peers? But wait, because you talked about the Boeing example around checking the plane and going through, and then if there's a change, that's kind of applied to everybody. I think it's really interesting because pilots do a walk around too before any flight. They do their own checks and they use checklists because they're in an environment much like, I guess, the medical world too, where they're often doing critical things where safety is paramount, but they're working with different people all the time. So they don't get the benefit of knowing what somebody means. And to reduce the risks of assumptions and roles, they use checklists, they individually do walkarounds, and they communicate that. I think that's really different. And I don't think that's how things work in big corporate organizations. And talking to you makes me think, why not? So... why is security so different in IT than like the quality assurance stuff that you've been talking about it? And isn't it like you said something like the risks that do happen or the when it goes wrong and when it goes wonky, it's not normally something on the risk register. What's the point in a risk register then?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think these are rhetorical questions. I think there's something about it being technical and I think mysterious to some people, and it intimidated a lot of people for a long time, and they just kind of deferred it to the experts. But then you realize most of the experts are really, you know, myopic on tech, tend to not have the business skills, not have holistic thinking skills, not be very good with people. You know, you don't see a lot of CISOs with MBAs. And that's kind of been allowed to spiral, and it's gotten ever more complex. And it's just kind of hidden behind this wall. And one of the problems is that there's no understanding of it, and that means there's no accountability. It's one of those very, very few fields where your management doesn't actually understand what it is you do. They have no way of evaluating whether you're good at it or not. And it's very easy to say, oh, well, we didn't get breached today, so I did a good job.
But that's hard with, because you mentioned the performance metrics too earlier. It's like totally different performance metrics around what demonstrates that you're doing well and how individuals are incentivized. Like that's like really challenging. And also I didn't think about it as CSOs. It's unusual to have a CSO that has an MBA. I spoke to one of our label mates, is an incredible kind of design UX leader who started the UK's first UX agency ages ago, and now kind of sit and I think he has a really interesting experience, and he told me the story that I think is actually a bit similar to what you were telling me. He told me that actually as a designer, when you move up into a leadership role, your peers are no longer
the designers and the like-minded community, your peers are the head of marketing. When you're a head of, your peers are the other head ofs. When you're director of, it's the other directors. Your peers change and you have to make that shift. You have to translate what the business needs and then shape your organization to what the business is. And I think it's actually a really similar thing that I'm hearing from you. And it makes me think, do you think there needs to be a separate chief security officer versus a CTO? And I guess that's maybe one thing to delve into. And what advice would you give to people who think in a similar way to you or want to operate in a way that you're kind of outlining, but their organization is a little bit behind them? What advice would you give to people building a teams to think differently? Because the theory makes sense. The messy middle of making that change, I think, is hard.
There's so many questions in there that you've asked me just now. Let's start with so I think there's definitely this, what you mentioned about like the peerage is definitely a problem, because we see this quite often, not just in security, but in some technical roles as well. And I've been dismissed for, you know, C-level positions of, oh, well, you're not technical enough. My peers aren't the technical ones. I need to go talk to the CFO and CEO about driving organizational change so that we can improve the quality of processes so we have fewer security issues. I'm not there to implement, you know, tools that some analyst is going to use to firefight. And I think, you know, around the KPIs, you hear about the cybersecurity skills gap all the time. And I don't think there is one at all. I think the big skills gap that there actually is a leadership or a holistic thinking or a critical thinking gap. And I think in many cases, we're hiring completely the wrong people. You talk about the skills gap, but there are so many people, you know, transitioning into cybersecurity because they've been told it's a hot career and all this stuff. They struggle to find work because everyone wants, you know, 5 years experience and this and that for an entry-level role. And I snap these people up and they were so happy to have a job. And I put them in more senior functions because even though it's their first security job, they've been working for 10 years in other roles. And I've got this analogy for the security industry where it's like a car factory. And, you know, there's a building and a car park next to it where the finished cars go. And there's an assembly line with like 100 stations. And these cars are going down this assembly line, finished product. And then they get pushed into the car park to get sold, except they get pushed from the third floor. So they land in the car park and they're all mangled. And, oh dear, we can't sell this. This is terrible. So we move it to the end of the car park. We build a little shed around it. We get some people in there with tools and we assess, well, what's the damage or the multiple things damaged? How do we prioritize? Okay, what parts need to be changed? What order do we have to disassemble, reassemble it to get to that part? What tools do we need for that? What's good enough because we can't fix everything, and let's build a framework for how we address these things, and let's get an auditor in just to make sure we stick to it, and let's get some consultants in to help us work better and some vendors to sell us better tools. And every 30 seconds, another car, and we need to ramp up this effort, and it takes way longer to fix than these defects are arriving. And I hire these people, and like my last team as a CISO was like former sales guy, a stewardess, a business owner, police officer, military technician, a teacher, and an IT architect, not a security architect, but an IT architect. And no one wanted to hire these people, which is ridiculous. And they stand there at the edge of this car park and they feel really intimidated because they see all this really complex technical work going on. And eventually they've got to ask me this really, really stupid question, which is, why are we dropping the cars from the third floor? And I have to tell them it's because these people over there are unable to look at the big picture and to go in there and have a conversation. And building a business case around it would be cheaper if we just built a ramp or made the assembly line go the other way. Now, in reality, the cars are actually being dropped off the third floor. Defects are being introduced along the assembly line. And you end up with a product with defects in it that has these security repercussions. But the general principle is that, like, we're hiring completely the wrong people. We're hiring mechanics. We need to be hiring people who think of the total cost of running that assembly line.
Do you think the CSO should be a separate role or sit with the CTO? How do you think that works in an organization? Because we're talking a lot about holistic thinking.
I do think you need a security team there are definitely some security operations. I think if you have a very security-minded CTO or CIO, you can do quite well. If you think of security as a quality function, then if you have a CIO or CTO who's very quality-focused, you know, really high quality of builds, maintenance standards, patching, architecture, all these things, then you probably have very few security issues to deal with.
Before we go over to the quickfire questions, I've got two things, and I'll be disciplined and only ask you two things.
Very bad at quickfire.
Well, we'll see. It must be hard for you, I imagine, when because I imagine you're kind of a somewhere in between, having quite different types of conversations and level of detail. So with your peers and team who understand security, you might be having one type of conversation, but then you have the head switch and probably translate that quite differently when you're kind of talking to your, I guess, exec peers too.
I used to try and translate, if I'm honest. I used to be quite good at like translating the technical into a bit more business relevant isn't the right word, to be honest. It was just the technical into English. But I've actually stopped doing that. I have a business conversation at that level, and I don't bother them with the technology. And then I have the more technical conversation at a low level. But I always try to get them to understand the bigger picture as to why they're doing it and think about it this way. And you know, if so-and-so is like, oh, yeah, we have all these vulnerabilities and the vulnerability management solution is found. I'm going to go and fix them. So slow down. Ask yourself, why do we have these vulnerabilities? What do they have in common? Like, what's causing them? And then you realize, oh, well, we've got 10,000 vulnerabilities and 3,000 of them are actually caused by this business process. Let's set up a call and have a chat with that team and explain it to them that they're causing 3,000 vulnerabilities a year, which is causing, you know, quite a bit of risk and quite a bit of money to mitigate. Maybe we can get them to change their process. Be friendly about it, and then I'll raise it to the CFO and get some pressure on them. So get them to think about the bigger context. But I no longer, it used to be tech to English, and now it's tech to business. So that's changed quite a bit. And you said something earlier about me thinking differently. And the funny thing, and why is security so different? The funny thing is security, the status quo is different. But security actually isn't. And when I first started, than other industries, I mean, when I first started kind of thinking this way, you know, 5-6 years ago, I thought, oh, I've just figured something out here, guys. I'm quite clever now. And then you speak to other industries in automotive and oil and gas, they're like, yeah, we've been doing that for about 60 years. But you just realize, like, why are we doing this? This makes perfect sense. And it's so relatable to executives as well, because this is how stuff works. It's only kind of, it's that lack of visibility and understanding of cybersecurity. And because we've made it such a technical thing about these threats that no one can actually explain to anyone, these risks and all these things, which, by the way, most of the threats out there, I'm going to say they're self-inflicted. Like we are responsible for the threat population, so to speak. The analogy I use is all the vulnerabilities that you are allowing to be in your organization, because you're not fixing them, you're only worrying about shielding, you know, building a wall between the threats and your vulnerabilities. The vulnerabilities are still attracting the threats. A bit like if I leave a bag of grain in my garden, I'm not surprised to have 10,000 mice the next week. In fact, I am responsible for there being 10,000 mice. And I don't go out and buy 10,000 mice traps. I remove the rice or the bag of grain or whatever. So that's what we're not doing. We're just trying to mitigate, buy more mouse traps. We're not actually realizing we caused this mess. We need to fix this.
I don't know if I was surprised earlier when you said the risks that normally come to fruition aren't on a register.
I think it depends on the level of thinking. So part of that is, we've built this new system and we've built all these security controls and we built this, that, but you've not dug deep enough. And then you find out that, but this is a virtual machine that's actually running on a very old Windows server, excuse me, which is vulnerable, and therefore they compromise that and they can compromise absolutely everything on top, regardless of how secure that is, because of that dependency is one. No one looks at, and that's just technical problems. And the other kind of technical problem is people have a lack of awareness of business process, or what the business processes of what's going on in other departments. And you'll see things like, I was recently talking to an airport, and they were explaining to me, I was talking to the head of infrastructure, it was all kinds of interesting stuff about everything from parking access to how the most critical system in the airport is probably the signs that direct people to the gates. Because if those break down, it's pandemonium. He said, arguably more important than the control tower. And then he mentioned that the conveyor belts that move the luggage around, so they have motors in them, obviously, electric motors. And they have sensors on them that monitor the voltage. Because when the voltage goes a bit squirrely, they know that motor is on its way out. That's going to burn out soon. So what they do is overnight, this maintenance firm comes in and replaces them. And it's actually this maintenance firm that monitors these motors. They put their little sensors on it, and that goes over the internet to them. And as soon as they see a motor is about to fail, overnight they come and they fix it. Then you ask, now how much cybersecurity do you think an industrial hardware maintenance company has? Probably not very much. Probably not very mature. And then you ask the CISO of that airport, are you aware that you've got this third-party company on your secure internal network behind the firewall? And the answer is no. So you spent 10 million quid on security technologies, but you have no idea about this backdoor. And there will be dozens more. And I think this is one reason why, no matter how much more we spend on security, until we start doing things holistically, that's why we there's no decrease. We still see it increasing. Because it's like, how many holes does it take in the bottom of your fish tank for you to have an empty fish tank? Unless you get everything, your investment's pointless. So we got to change the fundamental approach. You got to go stop doing cybersecurity and making an IT thing and start systematically going through your business processes and make sure they are secure. Do business securely, not cybersecurity.
With such a deep understanding of, I guess, cybersecurity threats and I guess your experience too as a young man, does it make you more or less confident? I guess you've got a real sense of what can go wrong and how many holes there can be in the fish tank. Does it make you more or less confident in your digital interactions? I guess in your, like, not working life, but in your life.
I have no trust in anything. Yeah, no, not very much. Actually, if I can add to those arguments, so I was talking about like the depth and the technical dependencies, but then the kind of more laterally, the awareness of what goes on in different departments. Those are the technical vulnerabilities, I guess, the technical problems. But very few people actually look at process ones or cultural ones. And I think that's a very interesting one. Sometimes I can see something, it's not vulnerable in per se, but it's a symptom of a cultural problem. And that immediately gives me pause. And I'll give you a great example I've been giving for years. This was about 4 years ago. I walked into an organization and they showed me a maturity assessment. And it was like a bar graph about these different areas in their IT operations teams. And they had anywhere from like a 2 out of 10 to a 10 out of 10. The average was about a 6. Excuse me. And they said, look, this is the assessment we've had made. Pretty good in some places, but you know, where we're a 2 and a 4, that's where we'd like you to come in and raise that up to like at or above our average. And I looked at this and I said, this is BS. I think your average is about a 1.5 out of 10. And they just looked at me like I was stupid, didn't know maths. And I explained to them, this is all your IT operations team, yeah? Yeah, okay. Explain to me how this team does this job 10 out of 10. Absolute perfection, complete attention to detail, every aspect considered, planned meticulously, documented, mature, everything. That same team, those same people with that same level of discipline and all these things do this task and they do a crap job at it. that just doesn't happen. You either care about something and you put in the work, or you don't. Or certainly the same people or group of people. Quite often you see it in leadership pockets within, you know, within organizations, that that team has a good leader and performs well, and vice versa. And I said, therefore, I think if whoever audited this, if they thought that was a 10, I'm sure they missed something, which means they probably missed some stuff with the 2. So I'm going to downgrade your 2 to a 1.5. And I'm going to say that culture is incredibly consistent. So I'm going to put 1.5 across the board. They thought it was crazy. But one guy liked me. A year later, a year spent uncovering stuff and realizing the stuff that was there, you know, the stuff that implemented maybe wasn't implemented very well, or yeah, we have this, but we've not enabled it. And oh yeah, we've introduced all these other things by doing that, and that was a problem, and that undermined this, that undermined that. And we did like a really in-depth Gartner assessment a year later, and the out of 10 maturity average was 1.6. And it was like 1.6, 1.6, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, 1.6, 1.8, 1.6. It was like you could put a ruler through it. People don't look at that as a root cause. If I have a team that is slapdash, that will continue causing problems. It doesn't have, I don't have to give you a concrete example. I can only look at two or three. If I see like two or three things that are like, this is a very bad behavior, is that anomaly or an outlier? If I see two or three of those, I'm like, no, these are cultural issues, cultural defects, slapdash work because of the mentality of that team that are happening and will continue to happen unless they're addressed. And that will eventually cause problems.
I guess you called it with that team really early on and you were very accurate.
Surprisingly so, yeah. Because I was one of the people to fill in that assessment, but several other people filled in the assessment and we all got like pretty much the identical result. Like,
well, I think a lesson in kind of, I guess, unpicking things and taking a critical eye, which I don't think possibly people do enough. Let me move to our quick fire questions, Greg.
Yes. Oh God, I thought that was it.
No, there's a few more.
Go on.
Can you describe your taste in interior design?
Shockingly bad. Actually, it's not. It's non-existent.
Well, you have no taste.
I have no taste. I have literally like 12 car posters in my living room. That's it.
Okay.
I need a woman's touch quite desperately.
In another life, what would your career be?
Definitely something motorsports related. There's a theme here, isn't there? Yeah, you can probably tell.
Yeah, well, you've told me you have 12 posters. Oh, lovely. What was the first work thing you were really proud of?
The first work thing I was really proud of. So my first real job was undercover work for the FBI and Defense Criminal Investigative Service. So can't really go into it. But to start seeing any kind of product of work and realizing that this is something that they had to bring you in for, that they couldn't do themselves.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Not so much a piece of advice. But the one thing that comes to mind in recent memory about 5-6 years ago was it was basically a coach. And he listened to my story because I was really struggling to fit in, if I'm honest. I've found my niche now, but at the time I basically just disqualified myself from every role by not thinking like everybody else. And he took a very long time to listen to me, be very supportive, got up, got a coffee, and then ripped me a new one. And he just absolutely criticized everything I did, everything I didn't do enough, everything I didn't do or didn't do. And it was a tremendous, at first I got all this defensiveness. And I remember that moment just kind of letting go of that defensiveness. And even though 90% of what he was saying was maybe I hadn't clarified or whatever, there were those little bits in there. And I just let all that wash over me and picked out the bits that I could grow from. And that made me realize that immense discomfort is actually growth, or at least opportunity for growth. So that led me to really embracing it. And I've literally had people start yelling at me at meetings because they were upset about stuff and ran out of time and scheduled meetings for them to continue yelling at me because A, it allowed them to vent. It allowed me to understand them better. It allowed me to enlighten myself. But yeah, that growth experience was quite significant. And it's nice to be able to take, sometimes people actually insult you and they're, well, actually that one little bit might be a little bit true. So let's take that on board, even though they're, you know, they're attacking you maliciously, you actually get something positive out of it.
That's a really great way of framing things around where is there opportunity to grow. Thanks for sharing that one. This is the last one. You'll be pleased to hear. On a scale of 1 to 10, this is what we ask everybody to, Greg. On a scale of 1 to 10, Greg, how weird are you?
I think most people would put me quite up there, yeah. Most people think they're perfectly normal, but objectively, people probably think I'm pretty weird.
I think that's a good place to end. Thank you so much for your time, Greg.
Thanks, Maxine.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.